You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
Based on our incremental recession phase model, we can hit like 2,300 over the next 12 months. That should definitely be possible. I think this divergence between, you know, very, very little interest, negative sentiment, and price action that is actually quite okay, I think that's a very, very positive sign. And as I've said before, the fact that gold is holding up so well against soaring interest rates, soaring bond yields, I think that's a sign of strength.
Hey guys, this is Brian Lenny of Mining Stock Education and Junior Stock Review. Today with me, I have Ronnie Stouffer of Incrementum and co-author of the In Gold We Trust report. Ronnie, it's great to have you. I think most investors, especially in the resource space, are probably obsessed with the interest rate movements that we've seen over the last year and a half. The Fed paused in June, but Powell has come out and said, you know, there could be two more hikes ahead. And so my question for you, is this merely verbal posturing, or do you think they really have the intention of raising rates in the second half of the year?
Well, hi, Brian. First of all, thanks for having me again. It's good to see you again. Well, from my point of view, we're very, very close to the end of this rate hike cycle. Obviously, it has been a very aggressive cycle. Basically, the toughest rate hike cycle in the last 40 years. So therefore, I would say that we should be seeing more consequences of this rate hike cycle over the next couple of weeks. And from my point of view, you know, a recession is basically our base case. I tweeted out last night the leading economic indicator, which is one of my very, very favorite indicator. It's the Conference Board's leading economic indicator that basically summarizes 10 different indicators that are basically, you know, they're leading and not lagging, and that's really important. So this leading economic indicator has declined now for 14 straight months. The last time we saw that was from April 2007 to May 2008. And we know what happened afterwards. So from my point of view, there are time lags involved, obviously. The Federal Reserve still thinks that they've got everything under control, that we will see a soft landing, a mild recession, Goldilocks scenario, whatever. From my point of view, that's not going to happen. So therefore, I would say I would be very, very surprised if we would see in 6 months from now interest rates at the same or even a higher level. I just don't see that. And therefore, I think, you know, I said recently at a speech, Jay Powell, he should be nominated for the next Academy Awards. He has been playing it really well. I think the market gained some credibility in markets again. But I think as soon as the market will realize the emperor has no clothes and that the recession is around the corner, then, of course, as always, they will have to back down and start lowering again.
In an interview with Zoltan Polzar in your most recent edition of the In Gold Trust report, Zoltan says the Fed can raise interest rates to 10%. We're still going to rearm, we're still going to friendshore, and we're still going to pursue energy transition. You know, this quote was in relation to war and the potentially positive effects that it could have. But my question for you is, or where is that breaking point between rising interest rates to quell inflation and, you know, government spending?
It's hard to really mention one or forecast one breaking point, but I think we're getting closer and closer. I think the main reason why, or let's say two main reasons why we aren't in a recession yet. First of all, because we're seeing an enormous amount of fiscal stimulus. I mean, the U.S. is basically at full employment at the moment, and the government is running, 7 or 8% budget deficit. So what's the budget deficit going to be like if we hit the recession? It's going to be double digits. So we called this monetary climate change in 2021 when we said, well, actually, we should focus less on what central bankers are doing and focus more on what fiscal policy is doing. And I think that 2020, the COVID crisis, was really the game changer for that. So fiscal policy probably is the main reason why we aren't in a recession yet. And the second reason probably is, I mean, I'm heading over to the U.S. in 2 weeks. But over here in Europe, wherever you go to, you know, the restaurants are full. People spend money. People, you know, enjoy, you know, going to the theaters, to the restaurants, going out. And I would say it can also be interpreted as a sign for, you know, kind of a loss of confidence in the future purchasing power of money. People say, well, actually, you know, inflation is so high. I just spend the money. I go on vacation. I buy stuff that I actually don't really need. Why should I, you know, put my money on or leave my money on a savings account? Risks in equity markets are too high for me. I don't like Bitcoin. Gold is too boring. Real estate is too expensive. So I would say that this kind of spending behavior is kind of a sign, perhaps a little bit like similar to, you know, the roaring 20s and those times before major inflation phases, that actually say, well, you know, very, very high time preference. I want to spend the money now because the future purchasing power of money will be falling. And that's not a good sign, obviously. So I think those are the two reasons why we're not in a recession yet. But from my point of view, you know, having a look at the yield curve, having a look at, as I mentioned, the leading economic indicator, having a look at the labor market, I think it's pretty clear that we are moving more and more into the direction of a recession.
So if I understand you correctly, it's the public's perception that the value of their money is going to lose its value, and therefore they're going out and spending money before they can buy less. Exactly. Is that essentially what Von Mies was talking about with the crack up boom scenario, where the people's perception is kind of like that leading, not indicator, but factor that propels us higher in pricing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, crack up booms often end up in hyperinflation. And in this year's report, we had a special chapter about the crack up boom. And you know, we analyzed it from a more academic point of view. Perhaps it's like early innings of a crack up boom that we're experiencing, and we always know how it ends. And one lesson from history, obviously, that is really worthy of consideration is that gold was always an excellent protection against such phases and the devaluation of the currency. So I think this loss of confidence in the future purchasing power is really something that we should follow very, very closely. However, one also has to mention that, you know, opportunity costs for holding gold are pretty significant at the moment. If you get on your, what is it, Apple Pay account, like more than 4%, if you get, you know, for the 10 years, roughly 4% on a 2-year bond, you're getting 4.8 at the moment. So that's pretty significant opportunity costs. And therefore, I think that given that perspective and given those moves in rates, I'm really astounded that the price of gold has held up so well. If you would have told me, Brian, like 1 year ago, what do you think, you know, where's the price of gold when a 2-year hits 4.8% and the 10-year hits like 4%, I would probably have said like 1600, 1700, not 1900.
So in your view, is gold exceeding expectation then? That's kind of the drift of what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that quite recently, I mean, up until May, I think gold held up extremely well, and then we also saw that, you know, that the yield curve began to steepen again. Then we saw the bank failures in spring, obviously, that were kind of papered over by the Federal Reserve. Now that the yield curve is inverting more again, we are seeing that equity markets are kind of breaking out. So I think that once, you know, the yield curve steepens again, I think this will be really the point in time when gold takes off. And we've got one really nice chart where you show that the big moves in gold always happened when we went into a downtrend in 2-year yield. So I think that's definitely something that we should follow very closely. I can tell you, Brian, from talking to institutional players, they couldn't care less about gold at the moment. It's not a topic at all. And you can also measure it if you have a look at ETF flows. While on the other hand, I think one major trend that we're seeing is obviously central bank buying. I mean, we saw an all-time high in central bank buying last year. This year is also going extremely well with, you know, central banks, for example, from Singapore, buying significant amounts of gold again. So I think this this trend of central bank buying, which is a consequence of the sanctions against the Russians from last year. I think this is really a pillar of this bull market in gold. But on the other hand, we will also need for a larger move, we will have to see institutional players coming in. And so far, we haven't seen that. So I think once we make new all-time highs in dollar terms, I think this will be the point in time when FOMO kicks in again. And then we should be seeing more institutional demand again.
Japan has been one of the best examples of, you know, quantitative easing over the last few decades. And for the better part of those last few decades, inflation has been nil. You know, they've been hovering, you know, they call them the lost decades. So if monetary expansion equals inflation, why has it taken decades to just this year showing, I think it was 4% at the beginning of the year, a pop in inflation?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, we have also seen, I mean, over the last decade, basically, central bankers did everything to get inflation numbers up. They kept telling us, well, inflation is too low, we have to do more. And then it suddenly broke out. And I think the main reason, obviously, that in 2020, we did not only see very aggressive central bank policy, but also very aggressive fiscal policy. And we saw over the last couple of, you know, episodes of quantitative easing that it actually, you know, it is an asset swap and it kind of stimulates the economy, but with a pretty big time lag. So primarily, I think quantitative easing stimulated asset price inflation, but not consumer price inflation. So that's really crucial. And now we are seeing, you know, with, as I've said before, this monetary climate change, where politicians basically found out in 2020, well, it helps me with my upcoming elections if I hand out, you know, checks to the taxpayers, pay them for, you know, sitting on the couch and watching Netflix. And I think that with the energy crisis in 2022, I think this was another confirmation that that fiscal policy has taken over now. And you know, obviously, if you get a check from the government, then, you know, the attitude regarding that money is completely different compared to, you know, really hard working for that money. It's like, you know, if you win $1,000 in a casino, most people are just going to waste it or you know. But coming back to Japan, I think, you know, if you have a look at the price of gold measured in Japanese yen terms, this is just one, you know, it's basically a piece of art. It's beautiful uptrend. And therefore, you know, we are seeing some sort of a Japanification of the Western world. And we've got one really interesting chart where we show, you know, that the Bank of Japan is a couple of years ahead, but we're definitely following their steps. And I think therefore it is a good example of where we're probably heading to.
But Rick Rule has a great quote that he often cites. He said, "I've seen the enemy and it is us." And I think kind of what you were describing sort of fits that, you know, the fiscal policy to match what people are asking for to get into office, it seems to ring true. And it's a quite interesting part in history where we are, considering all the debt that's out there, yet people still want the handout. They still want to be, you know, held by the hand forward. And it'll be interesting to see how that develops moving forward. You referred to gold consumption in 2022. You know, it's, and you have a great chart on the gold consumption, and it's, you know, it's straight up to the right. And, you know, if you look at who's buying the gold, it's dominated by the East, or maybe the BRIC nations is a better way to put it. In your view, is this consumption the prelude to the much talked about, you know, BRICS gold-backed currency?
I would be a little bit cautious when it comes to that. I mean, we've got the BRICS summit coming up, I think end of August in Johannesburg. You know, a new currency will be a topic, but I mean, we researched it and there's no real information about that. We will have on our Twitter channel, we will have some sort of a live coverage from the BRICS summit. I think it's going to be very, very interesting. But, you know, I think if we take a step back, Brian, I think it's pretty clear what's going on, and we described this this showdown that we're seeing, this geopolitical showdown
And the associated de-dollarization that is going on. It is something that we're writing about for 7 years already. And I think, you know, now definitely this de-dollarization is becoming more and more of a mainstream topic. And we're seeing that in BRICS nations and also SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they are becoming much more self-confident. And this self-confidence is obviously, it's a logical consequence of their increasing economic importance. So, for example, measured in purchasing power parity, the BRICS countries have a higher aggregate GDP than the G7 countries since 2021. We also see that, you know, they were responsible for the majority of the growth in the last 20 years. So 76% of global GDP growth in the last two decades was coming from emerging markets. We know that they've got 87% of the global population, and you know, their demographics are much more favorable, with the exception of Japan of China. We know that, you know, now they are responsible for 44% of global GDP, up from less than 20% in the year 2000, and they own 76% of global foreign exchange reserves. So I think we in the Western world should become less arrogant and just, you know, see what's going on in those countries. Go there, talk to people in Shanghai, in Dubai, in Mumbai, and especially when it comes to gold. I think it's super interesting. We've got a special chapter on the gold flows, where we say, well, actually, you know, Shanghai, Dubai, and Mumbai are probably becoming more important as gold hubs than Zurich, London, and New York. And I think people tend to forget the numbers, actually. The size of the gold flows into emerging markets is just staggering. For China alone, it was they imported since the year 2000 730 tons of gold every year on average. China and India in the last 20 years, they bought 35,000 tons of gold. Indian households at the moment, that's just an estimate, they hold more gold than the 27 largest central banks holding gold. So what I want to emphasize is, you know, those countries, they've got a very, very high affinity for gold. Gold is in their nature, in their culture. They've got less opportunities of diversifying into other asset classes. So for them, you know, buying gold as an investment is just, you know, one of the few choices. So I think that's clearly a very important major secular trend. If we will see a BRICS currency soon that is gold-backed, I've got my doubts, to be honest. I think this whole de-dollarization topic is a long process. I think we have to differentiate between trade currencies and reserve currencies. It's very, very important. I don't see that any other currency will be taking over, you know, the pole position as the world reserve currency from the US dollar very soon. But when it comes to the trade currency, I think we're seeing lots of bilateral agreements. And I think, you know, the symbolic character of, you know, the events that have taken place recently, I think that's really important. For example, we describe, you know, the last visit of President Biden in Saudi Arabia. You know, they had this fist bump, and it was a kind of a, you know, not really a very, it didn't really seem like a very, how do you say, something where both companies really enjoyed each other a lot. Well, if you compare it to the visit of President Xi Jinping in Saudi Arabia, first of all, you know, it was really huge. So they invested quite a lot of money, and then it was very, it seemed very intimate, and all those you know, reports coming out afterwards, it basically confirmed that they're talking really about a new paradigm, about a new era, and I think, you know, China China basically supporting the peace negotiations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That's from a diplomatic point of view. That's really a big achievement. So, you know, it's quite a lot going on. But as I've said, it's a process. It's going to take years, if not decades. But I think it's definitely something that will remain a very, very central topic.
In relation to the gold price, how big of a factor does the petro-yuan's convertibility into gold mean in the future?
Again, the importance of Asian markets is growing every day. The sophistication the trading, the settlement, all the infrastructure is really staggering. So if you have a look at the Shanghai Gold Exchange, for example, which is trading only physically backed futures contracts, if you have a look at the volumes traded there, it is becoming more and more significant. The impact on the gold price itself, it's hard to measure, I would say, but we are seeing that over the last couple of months, it seems that, you know, there's somebody really trying to pick the bottoms and to really buy the dips. So the price of gold isn't really coming down, although, as I've said, opportunity costs have risen significantly. Real rates have risen significantly. And as we emphasize in our work, the absolute level of real interest rates, but even more importantly, the direction and the momentum of real interest rates are probably the most important drivers for the price of gold. And the fact that gold has held up so well, even though we saw a huge move in real rates, this is telling me that, you know, perhaps the trading patterns have changed. And I think, you know, as I've said, the numbers that are the volume that is being traded in Asia nowadays, it is becoming more and more of a driver. So long story short, I think we as gold investors, we should really focus much more on what's going on in the Asian world. We also know that they are, from a trading behavior, I think, especially India, they're acting very, very much, you know, counter-cyclical. So they enjoy buying low and they sell high. So every time the price of gold rises too much, you see that, recycling supply from India is picking up big time. While we in the Western world, you know, we tend to be much more pro-cyclical. So we sell when the price falls and we buy when the price rises. So therefore, I think, yeah, focus more on what Asia is doing and less what the Western world is doing.
I want to go back to the concept, basically East versus West. And you mentioned before, countries like India, Brazil, they do have a demographic advantage over the West. But in my experience, like I worked for a Brazilian company out of school. I worked there for about a decade. And Brazil was always touted, and this is going back, I guess, 20 years ago when I started there, was always touted as the next thing. And not only that, but I can remember the company I worked for invested in India. And they said, you know what? Brazil is the next thing. India is the next thing. And it never really happened. And so my question for you is, seemingly there's a lot of factors that go into what drives, an economy or a society forward. But when you look at the numbers, and you stated a few numbers about the gold consumption and some of the economic values of basically East versus West, but does this really just come down to the US versus China? Is that really the most important factors or two countries we're looking at when we talk about the West versus the East?
No, I think it's more than the US versus China. I've recently I've only been to Shanghai, and every time I go there, it's just staggering. This feels like New York probably was like a couple of decades ago. Yeah, it's so modern and buzzing, and it's the same with Dubai and with Singapore, and Jakarta is developing really, really, really well. I haven't been to Saudi Arabia so far, but what friends are telling me is it's really staggering how this country is opening up. So I see your point, and I think that emerging markets always suffer from the strength of the US dollar, basically. So they suffer from the tightening So they are debt getting more expensive. Then they also suffer from the strength in the US dollar, where the large parts of the debt are based in. And therefore, you know, emerging markets often suffer much, much more from rate hike cycles and those boom and bust cycles. However, I think what's been really interesting lately was obviously last year the US dollar was extremely strong. But then we saw some emerging market currencies like the Brazilian real, for example, but also the Mexican peso. I think even the Thai baht holding up really well. So that could be one sign that actually something is changing. I'm by no means an emerging market expert or investor, but from what I see, you know, talking to people, you know, reading reports just trying to understand what's going on. I think it's pretty clear that the US will not give up its privilege of issuing the world reserve currency. That's crystal clear. But on the other hand, I think it's for a good reason that those emerging markets are showing much, much more confidence. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to be, you know, how to say it, scaremongering. But at the end, we have to say that, you know, if the US would be truly, or the US dollar would be truly threatened, then the US would probably use its military to enforce the use of the US dollar as a global reserve currency. And they will also use dollar liquidity. They will use repo and swap lines as a weapon to support and to enforce US foreign policy, like as we have seen it basically with Russia. I mean, basically kicking them out of the SWIFT system. And also, you know, with the stroke of the pen saying there are 300 billion in currency reserves are basically worthless. That could also be, you know, a big advertising campaign for gold, because, you know, then as a country that is perhaps somewhat critical of US policy, of course, I mean, you want to diversify your US dollar exposure, and you want to own a currency or an asset that is highly liquid, that is accepted all over the globe, and that doesn't have any counterparty risk. And I think that gold qualifies pretty well for that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very complex topic.
Absolutely. I just want to go back to the gold back, or the potential or theoretical gold back brick currency. And to me, you know, we talked about, you know, society and its want to, you know, have handouts and basically a ever increasing money supply. So if we're talking about a gold back currency, hypothetically, what would it actually mean to have it gold backed? Like, obviously, to me anyways, they're not going to put a restriction on monetary expansion, or at least I don't think so. So what does it actually mean to be gold backed, do you think, for a potential brick currency or any currency to be gold backed in the future?
I don't think that they really want to have a gold backed currency, to be honest, because it would restrict them. I think that it would be mainly for creating confidence in a new currency. I always mentioned the example when the euro was introduced. There were like advertising campaigns where they said, "Well, we've got in the eurozone, we've got more than 12,000 tons of gold," and this was basically done to create confidence and you know, trust in the new common currency. And I think that gold is a, like the Dutch National Bank wrote a while ago, that gold is a trust anchor, and that if you really want to play with the big guys, you want to have good amounts of gold in your vault. So therefore, I think, you know, Brian, it's no coincidence. You know, the US has more than 8,000 tons of gold, the eurozone more than 12,000, the IMF has more than 3,000 tons. The Chinese are buying like crazy, and we all know that they own 1,000 and 2,000 tons of gold. The Russians have been buying. Turkey is buying. I think that all the major players, actually, you know, they've got pretty decent amounts of gold. And I think, you know, if the BRICS now want to establish some sort of a new currency, I think they will use gold as this kind of trust anchor to create confidence in this new currency. But they don't want to have 100% gold-backed currency. I just don't see that.
Every developed nation has either developed or is in the process of developing a central bank digital currency. You know, with the advent of crypto over the last couple of years, you know, Bitcoin has been all over the place. It seems like we're definitely headed towards digital money. My question for you is how, or maybe when, what is that catalyst to bring CBDCs into society?
Well, in the Eurozone, they're talking about 2026 for the e-euro. And if you have a look at, you know, the Bank for International Settlements, the studies that they publish, but also the Federal Reserve and most other important central banks, I think it's crystal clear that CBDCs are the way to go. My main point regarding CBDC is that actually, you know, you can do it, but then the banking system will have to completely change. And we know that, you know, lobbyists in the banking industry are quite powerful. So I'm not sure if they really want to take over the job of money creation, if they want to take it up from commercial banks. If yes, then our traditional commercial banking system and the way how money is created will fundamentally change, period. I think the trend is clear. I mean, we all know that it's got nothing to do with the idea of Bitcoin, which is decentralized, where there's not one bureaucrat saying, well, this is the right interest rate, this is the right money supply. However, I think it's kind of riding this momentum of, you know, everything that is digital and has blockchain in its description is kind of cool. But if you really, you know, if you really understand it, then it's exactly the opposite of what Satoshi Nakamoto had in mind.
In your report, you mentioned that a US CBDC would be a threat to the US dollar system that we currently have. And I was just confused about what that threat would be. Like, why wouldn't the US implement a CBDC? Like, how would that impact the current US dollar system?
Oh, okay. I think that's what Zoltan said in the interview, if I got this right. As I've mentioned, I think, you know, what's JP Morgan and Citi and Wells Fargo gonna do if the Federal Reserve will be responsible for money creation? Of course, there's still asset management and perhaps some other services, but it would be a fundamental change of the banking industry as we know it. And of course, I mean, that's fine. I don't really think that we need banks as we know it anymore. But as I've said, you know, if you have a look at the very close ties between politics and banking, if you have a look at, you know, the number of jobs that would be lost, that's pretty significant. So I'm not 100% sure in which direction it will go. But obviously, if we would see, you know, the Federal Reserve being able to basically give out loans and every citizens to have his Fed account. George Orwell would be quite proud or quite frightened probably. We definitely shouldn't rule it out. I mean, that's what we're seeing in China already. I cannot rule it out, but we'll see. But I think, you know, it's, if you really want to dig into this topic, and we wanted to do a chapter in this year's In Gold We Trust report, but there's just so much going on, then just have a look at the web pages of the central banks. I mean, they're pretty open about that. I think they know that most people couldn't care less about it and they just don't read what they're publishing. But there's quite a lot of material already there. Obviously, it will primarily be used, you know, or the reason behind it is, of course, to to avoid, you know, tax evasion and terrorist financing and stuff like that. I'm not 100% sure if this really the main reason, but you know, it's definitely gonna go into that direction.
To end our conversation, I think most of the listeners want to hear where you think the gold price is going to end up by the end of the year. Are we going to be higher than today's level, which I think is around 1920, or lower? What do you think?
I think in the next 12 months, we should see new all-time highs. So my kind of base case would be that in Q3 and then especially Q4, I think we'll realize that we'll head into a recession. Now, what's normally going to happen over the course of a recession? Well, you know, usually when the recession is announced, the worst is already over. I think from, you know, having a close look at the yield curve, which is, you know, a very, very reliable recession indicator, it's screaming recession. Once the steepening starts, I think we will get much closer to the recession. Then I already mentioned the leading economic indicator. I think the labor market is doing worse. So from my point of view, a recession will become the main topic in the second half of the year. Gold tends to do really well over the course of a recession. We crunched the numbers actually in this year's report and said, well, every recession has different phases. Now, how does gold work during each of those phases? What about mining stocks? What about silver? What about the S&P 500? I think it's pretty interesting that you know, like in the middle stage of a recession, that's probably the stage where everybody's really panicking. So the middle until the end of the recession, this will really be the point in time when it's reflation is happening. This is the point when central bankers start panicking, when fiscal policy really kicks in, and this is the time to really start loading up on silver, on commodities, on mining stocks, and so on. While gold works really well in the earlier stages of a recession. But on average, since 1971, gold was up 10.6% over the whole recession on average, which is a quite decent performance. So I think one of the key takeaways is if a recession hits, and this is our main case, then gold should do really well. This also means that, you know, prior to that, I think that silver and commodities will face some headwinds. And we're already seeing that, you know, just have a look at the gold-silver ratio. If you look at commodities, for example, precious metals are doing okay-ish. But then base metals that are more sensitive to the economic cycle are clearly underperforming. Energy is not doing so well. On the other hand, agricultural commodities that are less sensitive are doing really well. So I think those, you know, this kind of intermarket analysis is already suggesting that we're moving into recessionary environment. And therefore, I think that, you know, based on our incremental recession phase model, we can hit like 2,300 over the next 12 months. That should be definitely be possible. And this will be the point in time, Brian, when I think if we hit new all-time highs, then many institutional players will actually, you know, walk away from the sidelines just watching gold and start buying. And I think this will be the point in time when this FOMO kicks in. At the moment, as I've said at the beginning, people couldn't care less about gold. And, you know, if you have a look at the gold price, we're not too far away from all-time highs. If you have a look at gold in measured in some other currencies like the Japanese yen, for example, it is basically trading at new all-time highs. So I think this divergence between, you know, very, very little interest, negative sentiment and price action that is actually quite okay, I think that's a very, very positive sign. And as I've said before, the fact that gold is holding up so well against, you know, soaring interest rates, soaring bond yields, I think that's a sign of strength.
Ronnie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Where can our viewers look to download their copy of the In Gold We Trust report and learn more about Incrementum?
Well, our company webpage is incrementum.li. We're a boutique asset manager based in Liechtenstein. We manage funds that focus primarily on commodities, gold, real assets, I would say. And then if you want to, if you've got time, you know, when you go on vacation for some good reading, you can download the In Gold We Trust report on our webpage, ingoldwetrust.report. You can download it for free. You don't have to register for anything. We also have other publications like a monthly chart book also available for free, thanks to our premium partners. There's also a compact version of the report, as we know that not everybody is keen on reading 420 pages about gold. Yeah, so that's basically it. And I'm also quite active on Twitter. My handle is @RonStoeferle.
Guys, the In Gold We Trust report is a must read for any gold investor. I highly suggest you follow the web addresses, and we'll link to them in the description. Ronnie, again, thanks, and hopefully talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Brian. All the best to you and all your listeners, viewers, and yeah, have a great summer.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.